Rowan Griffiths is one of a handful of scientists at the forefront of new research on psychedelics. A neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins University, he's been studying the effects of mind-altering drugs for decades. Now he's turned his attention to one of the classic hallucinogens, psilocybin, commonly known as magic mushrooms. What he found is startling. Most of his research subjects reported life-changing mystical experiences. Steve Paulson caught up with Griffiths at a recent conference on psychedelics. They talked about his findings and some of the early research on hallucinogens.
Psilocybin really first became available for experimental work back in the late 1950s, and there was a lot of research conducted very early on. And then we had the 1960s and Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary with his famous LSD experiments.
And his famous slogan, turn on, tune in, drop out. And he really, in combination with the excessive use of psilocybin and LSD, it really ended up leading to a drug abuse epidemic. And Leary's active promotion of the non-medical use of these compounds gave a scientific approach to studying these compounds a very bad name.
So the government stepped in and said, forget it. There can be no study of any of these kinds of substances.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It was really a consensus decision. So no single person in government said, you can't do this. Getting approval for research of this type got incrementally more difficult. The Drug Enforcement Administration made it more difficult. The funding sources for doing this kind of research dried up. And then even within the academic community, there was some sense that these compounds were just too dangerous to study. And so it wasn't as though they were really banished, but they were functionally banished by all these hurdles that were put up.
Did you have a hard time convincing your university to approve the study?
Well, I can put it this way, that I've been doing clinical pharmacology research for over 30 years, and approval of this trial was an order of magnitude more difficult than any other trial I've gotten approval for. And that difficulty came both at the level of the Food and Drug Administration and our own institutional approval. But by my way of thinking, my institution was doing the right thing. There was this cultural bias against doing research like this, so they really needed to be convinced that the risk-benefit ratio was favorable to allow this kind of research to go forward.
So here you were. You finally got the go-ahead to do your study. How did you set it up? Who were your research subjects, and how did you design the study?
Well, our first study was really done as a straight-out comparative pharmacology study. We thought just a very careful characterization of the effects of a high dose of psilocybin relative to some active control compound would be of value. I personally was interested in spiritual aspects of drug effects.
But, and that's really what you were studying, right? I mean, what kinds of, I suppose you could say, what kinds of mystical experiences might have been induced by taking psilocybin?
No, we were studying more broadly the effects of psilocybin relative to methylphenidate. Now, we had a number of...
That is Ritalin.
That's Ritalin.
All your research subjects were taking both psilocybin and Ritalin, and you were comparing the results?
Yeah, the design of the trial was one in which volunteers participated for two or three sessions, and they all received a high dose of psilocybin and a high dose of methylphenidate. However, the volunteers and the people monitoring the study with them in their room didn't know that it was only a comparison of psilocybin versus methylphenidate. So we were really controlling for expectancy. People thought that they could receive a high dose of psilocybin or low or medium doses of psilocybin. They thought they could possibly receive methylphenidate, but 11 other compounds as well. Dextromethorphan and caffeine and nicotine.
So they really had no idea what they were getting.
And then another important feature is that the volunteers had no experience with classical hallucinogens. So they couldn't definitively recognize the effects of psilocybin if they got it.
How many people participated in your study?
In our first study, 36 volunteers participated. Their mean age was 46 years. They were highly educated. It was really a high-functioning professional group. We had physicians and ministers and nurses and pastoral counselors and business owners, consultants. They were people who were curious. Most of them had some kind of interest in spirituality. We did that because of the long cultural historical use of psilocybin in religious contexts.
So what did you find when these 36 people took their psilocybin?
All the other questions that we were prepared to answer about the difference between methylphenidate and psilocybin dropped away as trivial when what emerged was this effect on questionnaires that are designed to measure primary mystical experience.
So this is the kind of thing where people talk about the unity of everything and sort of the breaking down of boundaries between yourself and the rest of the world, that kind of oceanic feeling?
Yeah, there's several defining characteristics, but first and foremost is exactly that, the sense of unity, the sense of the interconnectedness of all things. And then closely coupled with that is a sense of deep reverence or sacredness. There's something very special about this experience, something that's awe-inspiring, being in the presence of the majesty of whatever it is. And then this is coupled with this quality of a noetic sense. There's some informational value about this experience that makes it seem more real than everyday waking consciousness. People can absolutely know at a very deep and profound level that they're familiar with this experience and that it's very real. And then the other qualities of the experience are often that there's a sense of heart opening. Some people describe it as infinite love or peace. There's a transcendence of time and space, where past and present drop out and people come into the very present moment. And then there's a sense of ineffability that people can't put this experience into words. In our study, our first study, 61% of the volunteers fulfilled all those criteria.
61%? I mean, you're talking about really a profound reaction.
Yes, and our subsequent study has shown 75% of people fulfill these criteria for having a mystical experience. What really makes it interesting, though, is not just the description of the effect itself, but the fact that 2 months after the session and 14 months after the session, people came back and filled out questionnaires and we interviewed them. And the attributions made to this experience are undiminished. People are reporting that this experience is among the most personally meaningful and spiritually significant experience of their lifetimes.
In terms of the actual numbers there, wasn't it something like 70% said that this was among the top five most meaningful experiences in their life?
Yes, yep, that's exactly right. And so people would compare this to a birth of a firstborn child or the death of a parent. These are profound and deeply memorable events, and people are comparing this 6-7 hour session in our laboratory to that kind of event in their life.
Didn't you also have some not so positive results, people who reported great fear and anxiety?
Indeed, we did. And I think that's very important to emphasize here, that in spite of the careful selection we did and the hours of preparation we did with our volunteers prior to the session and the very safe environment that we created, which involved laying on a couch with eye shades and headphones in the presence of two people, in spite of all that, 30 to 40% of people had experiences of great fear sometime during the session. In most cases, that fear then transformed into something else, and in a lot of cases, people valued that experience. But in its extreme form, this sense of anxiety and fearfulness is really quite striking. It just underscores the risk that people undergo if they use these compounds outside of a setting in which they're closely monitored and supervised.
Now, you said that all the people in your study, at least in your first study, had spiritual interests, were either actively part of a church or just were inclined toward spiritual interest. Do you think results would be different if atheists participated? I mean, would they be less susceptible to such mind-altering experiences?
Well, that's a great question and one that we would love to have the funds to address. My thought is that someone who was absolutely committed, a committed non-believer, that it strikes me as very improbable that an experience of this sort is going to have them find God, if you will. It's possible, but it seems unlikely. But yet, an experience of this sort may be languaged in a different way, one in which people say, this was the most meaningful experience of my life. I don't believe that stuff about God, but I understand the interconnectedness of all things. I'm not going to use the term sacred to describe it, but I'm humbled by it. And, you know, and then you're coming pretty close to what some people would call spirituality.
That's Roland Griffiths, a behavioral biologist at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He talked with Steve Paulson at a conference on psychedelics and consciousness at the Biopharmaceutical Technology Center in Madison, Wisconsin.